This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Bueller.
Ferris, where are you? Is that your child? Does it matter if you take kids out of school without authorization? Do you care whether it's for holidays or appointments? Is it a problem if parents are taking children out of the schoolroom when principals have not approved? I'm Mary Guerin. This is The Conversation Hour. And in the latest figures from 2024, public school kids missed a combined 16.3 million days of school. To put some sense into that, it's about 25 days per child in that year. And 45% were a result of travel, unexplained absences, or parent choice for reasons not approved by the school. Now, I'd love to hear from you. Do parents know best? Is it about just ignoring bureaucracy there? Are you a parent who's had to take your kid out? Maybe because the holidays between terms are just too expensive, or the rigours of your family life, and is that fair enough? But maybe you're a teacher or a principal saying Bueller over and over that sees this trend. Do you see what effect it has on the kids? I'd love to hear from you today to reflect on those figures. Does it matter? We'll talk to a former principal who can talk about possible effects on that child. Also today, are you like Amy? Do you go back to black? Will you defend to the end your right to wear black? It is, of course, the cliche. Melburnians obsessed with black. Is that you and why? I'd love to hear from you. It turns out it's not just about fashion. It apparently makes a lot of sense. And not just because it's easier to coordinate when you're tired in the morning. Why do you wear black? Is it just a Melbourne thing? Are you wearing black in Bendigo or Ballarat or Beechworth or even anywhere not starting with a B? I'd love to hear from you. Are you resisting that pop of colour? There are some reasons, good, complex reasons apparently, that we'll talk about why people do wear black, or have you thrown off the black shackles? Next, what is the problem with taking your kids out of the schoolroom without principal's approval?
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
Joining me now is former school principal and CEO of the Country Education Partnership, Mark McClay. Thanks for joining me, Mark.
Morning, and I do love that movie, Sarah's Bueller's Day Off.
Well, do you like it in your classroom, Mark? What do you think about those figures? 45% of absences in 2024, a result of travel, unexplained absences or parents' choice for reasons not approved by the school. I'm asking people if that is you. Mark, what do you think?
Look, for certainly for unapproved absences and without letting the school know, I would certainly agree that that's an area the schools can work on, building those relationships with families to try and find out why and see how they can do that better. But in regard to family holidays, I think that's a different kettle of fish, because we are big advocates for family holidays and the benefits you get from them. And if they have to occur in school time due to financial reasons, could be cultural events. With rural families, it's seasonal. Mm-hmm. They only get certain times they can be off the farm. Then we're fully supportive of that. And there's plenty of things children can do when they're away with their parents that still have an educational benefit.
Yes, so you mentioned there those different reasons in the regions. Does that mean that probably that some of those numbers do come from the regions, that a large proportion might come from there? Is this a common event?
Yeah, and that's what schools can actually filter their data, so they can really nail down to who are the what are the real issues there. So look, families do in regional areas sometimes have to take a day off to go to an appointment because they're not going to get back in time. So that's par for the course. But yeah, regional and rural schools do have some of those type of absences. But as I said, it's just about communicating with families and things where the school doesn't know is not good. You certainly want that sort of open level of dialogue.
Mm, so what you're saying is it doesn't matter what the parents' reasoning is, just let them know beforehand, and does that make it more likely to be approved by the principal, do you think, Mark?
Yeah, and I would err on the side of passing judgment. I mean, you don't know anyone's story. School should be in very much a supportive mode. You know, is there any issues here, any dramas? Even the extent school's there to look at what they do between 9 and 9.30 every morning. Like, is it appealing? Is that the reason why, you know, students aren't coming or taking mental health days or other reasons? So, yeah, it's the whole picture, really.
Mm-hmm. Why would you take your kid out of school without public principal's approval? 1300 222 774 is the number to call. You talk about the educational value of holidays. I would argue that just about anything could be educational. What do you mean by that? What are the sort of the minimum standards of holidays, do you think, for kids of school age?
Oh, I can tell you, if parents ever come and want a schoolwork, I'd be vehemently against it, because I go, there's opportunities there from looking at maps to distances travelled, to fuel prices, to menus, to town information, to keeping a diary for some. There's just so many learning opportunities, and there's nothing wrong with schools suggesting those things to parents. They might have not thought of those, but there's just so many opportunities. But at the end of the day, they're going to have some lifetime memories made with their families that you've got to put a value on that. They'll be things they'll remember into their 30s and 40s.
Oh, even beyond, Mark. Yeah. Ray, you've called from Moonee Ponds. How do you approach this?
Yeah, good morning to the both of you. Thank you for the opportunity to talk. Both of us, so me and my wife are both emergency services workers. So we get pretty generous holidays, but we don't get an opportunity often to say when those holidays occur. So our kids come with us whenever those holidays are scheduled, and that might be once a year generally, and we might take them overseas if we're lucky. And I think the opportunity they get from experiencing different culture, food, just the travel itself, that outweighs for us anyway, or it certainly adds to the value of education. We don't think all education takes place in a classroom.
Exactly. Do you get any pushback from the school, Ray?
No, they're generally happy. And our kids are young, so they're in, you know, low primary school, grade basically prep and two. So we don't think they're missing out, and we do make them do stuff. And they're going, we're taking them to Bali, we're taking them to Malaysia. They have to learn some basic phrases. They have to learn some numbers. They've got to do some schoolwork, which we get from the school before we go.
And oh,
really,
Ray,
for a long time.
You lean in.
You can do both.
They are lucky kids, Ray. Thank you. Kate, you've called from Fountain Gate. What do you think?
Yeah, hi. I'm just a bit curious as to, hang on a sec. I've got the radio going as well, sorry.
No worries.
I'm a bit curious as to why there's a need for families to get the approval from school in order to take their kids out of school for a day or a holiday or something.
You think it's just the parents' choice?
I just kind of think along the parallel as an adult, my employer isn't allowed to ask me why I'm not coming to work for the day. It's considered none of their business and privacy and all of that. And I just think it's probably, school is effectively work for kids. So they shouldn't be, it should be a similar situation where it's not really up to the school to decide if it's okay the child to be there or not. It's
okay,
up to the family and the parents.
Okay, Kate, while I've got you on the phone, Mark, what do you think of Kate's point? Why do you need to ask that permission?
No, she's got a valid point, and it should be just parents advising the school the general reason, whether it's family holiday, medical appointment. So the parents are asked to give a reason, and that's, to be honest, that's where it should probably end. So we shouldn't really have a situation where they're having to seek approval, they're just giving a reason.
So it's about more about notifying them than
correct
approving them. Kate, what do you think? Is that fair enough?
Yeah, I agree. And I would actually add that we took our son on an overseas trip for 5 to 6 weeks when he was in grade 6 a few years ago, and it was a fantastic opportunity for him to explore the world a bit, and especially in the lead up to then commencing secondary school.
Yeah.
So, I think that's many benefits.
That's right, Kate. And as Mark said, just those memories are the things that might just stay a little bit longer beyond learning algebra or whatever. Thank you so much for calling in. We're talking about holidays, about whether they need to be approved or not. In 2024, 45% of absences were not approved by school. Does it matter? With me is Mark McClay, who's CEO of the Country Education Partnership, also has been a principal in his time. Mark, I guess, yes, it's all those things on the ledger of why you could and should potentially take your kid out. What are the dangers? What are the situations where you would advise against it?
Yeah, I guess we've had students who've taken holidays for birthdays or for they're just a bit tired or it's cold or range of those sort of reasons. That's when you again just want to communicate with the school's wellbeing team. To see is there a remedy for this situation? And I guess I just want to add there's another group who we really like to take holidays during the term, and that's people like dentists. If I ever took my kid to the dentist during the holidays and I found out they weren't available because they were on holidays, I used to get peeved off, I think. I'm trying to do the right thing here.
Absolutely. Yeah. Then when you have to work around them, that makes it harder again. And Mark, I assume also it's different for kids in their very last years of school when attendance is more important.
Oh, yeah, I'm definitely talking year nine and under. And to me, every school should know every family or child who's got a bit of an attendance issue that they think are concerned, and they should have steps that they're trying to put in place. But yeah, year 10, 11, 12, whole different kettle of fish, really.
Sue, you've called from Geelong. What's been your experience?
I just returned to Geelong from 6 weeks in WA. My daughter went over to do something pretty amazing with her and her husband. So he is off for the whole term. He's in grade six. They consulted with the school and talked about him doing out of school distance ed, but they felt me coming with them, me being an ex-teacher, we would work. So every day we sat and did some schoolwork. He wrote sentences about what we'd done that day, what his mum and dad had done. We collected brochures that he'd cut up. We took photos. He wrote about them. He wrote letters to he sent emails to his teacher and his classmates.
Oh, that's terrific.
About what he'd been done. So I think the experience for him, the only thing he probably missed out on was mathematics because we added up the kilometres travelled. We put in the price of fuel, given that we paid $3.60 something for diesel at one point. Totaled how far the family had driven.
So it sounds like you've done pretty well with the maths.
Yeah, no, it was a great, it was really, really a wonderful thing. He was reluctant to read his grade six novel, so I read that. And then his mum said, we've found it as an audio book, we'll listen to it in the car.
So, Sue, do you think that then the lessons themselves actually stuck potentially a bit more in that circumstance?
I think he missed his schoolmates. I think he missed the social aspect. He would often FaceTime with them and send them messages and emails. But I think the experience of being away, seeing animals, travelling distances, seeing wonderful parts of Australia, meeting lots of different people, interacting with people. He was interviewed by ABC Radio, TV, radio, all of that sort of stuff when his mum did it. I think the experience for him was fantastic.
Wow, he packed a lot in. You all did. Sue, well done. Thank you. I think you might be inspiration for quite a few people listening. Mark, I've got some texts here pointing out the logistical problems that leaves for schools as well in terms of teachers dealing with absences, let alone for principals as well. I know from my experience when we had kids in the UK system, they were incredibly strict, which did lead to horrendous school holiday prices and so forth. Are you pretty confident that where we land in Australia between that need to be at school and not, we've landed in a good place?
I think so. I think the flexibility, especially for rural, is understandable. And, I actually have friends from Austria who had to get Education Department approval to take holidays during school term. So I know different countries operate differently. But I think building a better relationship with parents is just as important as anything else. And if that's demonstrated by showing a bit of understanding to their situation, I think it's warranted, and we'll just have to work around the complications of the absentee periods that results in.
Mark, it was Lucky Kids who had you as their principal, obviously. Thank you for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
Mark McClay is CEO of the Country Education Partnership. This on text, I'm sorry, I'll give permission to my child to have a day off, not the school principal. And this, my kids are adults now, but we, their dad and I, took them out of school for family holidays. Sometimes it might have tacked on to school holidays, sometimes it didn't. Provided them with life experiences, they explore, learn about foreign currency, time zones, various cultures, and they would write postcards to their classes. Keep those texts and calls coming about taking kids out of school. And also join the conversation later this hour. Why do you wear black? We're going to dig into this because apparently it makes not just fashion sense to wear black. And is it all about Melbourne or not? Is it across the state? I'd love to hear from you. But next, with One Nation's conservative populism on the rise, you might have heard the polling this morning saying, yep, they are outflanking even Labor as well as the coalition. Is this the moment in Australia for progressive populism?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
As I said, with those polls this morning, One Nation's primary vote, which has been rising, now it's pipped Labor as well. It's against both major parties. And this has been the rise of populism from the right, from conservative parties. Connecting with anger is how populism is often characterised. We had the English Green Party leader tell the Australian Green Party over the weekend that it needs to connect with the anger on the left to counter this right-wing populism. Joining me now to talk about it is Dr. Zarei Gazarian, who is a senior lecturer in politics and international relations at Monash University. Thank you so much for joining me, Zarei.
Thanks so much for having me, Mary.
Just as a bit of an example of what populism means, let's have a little listen. Pauline Hanson, One Nation leader, of course, was speaking with our colleague Steve Austin on ABC Brisbane this morning, and here she is talking about skilled migration.
Big problem that we have, Steve, we can't keep bringing in these people. And you say we're bringing in these migrants at the moment for skills. Well, I'll tell you, 72-73, we brought in 739,000 people. Only 51,605 had skills, and of that, only 1,800 in the construction industry. So they're telling you lies, bringing out people with skills. They don't. These are usually Uber drivers, nail technicians, masseuses, and these skills that we don't need in Australia.
So that was Pauline Hanson talking on ABC Brisbane this morning. Zarei, can you take that example, I guess, of the message that's coming from One Nation and just give us a bit of a background briefing? What is populism, whether it's on the left or the right?
It's been really interesting to see populism in contemporary politics, I think, Mary. When I started doing my PhD about 20 years ago, there was this sense that there's this idea that's lurking around, but we're not really seeing evidence of it in mainstream politics. But now when we talk about populism, I think we talk about it as being part of the mainstream. And certainly a key feature of populism is this sense that there is a division between those who are making the laws and those who are the ordinary public. And I think that is at the core of the debate that both right and left populists seek to exploit. This idea that laws are being made, decisions are being made by elites that are out of touch with what the ordinary citizenry demands. And that is such a potent message, especially when we think about economic debates, which are really where the populists tend to have the most impact in the policy debate.
You're listening to Dr. Zarei Gazarian, who is Associate Professor in Politics and International Relations at Monash University. As I said, the English Green Party leader, Zach Polanski, on Saturday night advised the Greens here to connect with anger, that they start to do that, to learn from the storytelling power, quote unquote, of populist right-wing politics. What would progressive populism look like?
It really does make sense, as we know from Polanski's speech. It's really about harnessing the sense of disillusionment in the community. And I think he talks about taking the anger, essentially, to reject the status quo. And that is essentially what the right of centre populists have been doing. They've been really focused on trying to attack the status quo, the established parties, the successive policies that are focused on economic rationalist thought, neoliberal policies. And that is what the attempt is for the left, to also acknowledge that the status quo has led to systems where people are feeling as though they are left behind, systems where people feel that economically they're no better than they were 10 years ago, and more importantly, I think, Mary, the sense that the current policy trajectory of the established parties is not going to advance their interests in the longer term.
So some examples so people can relate and see whether that's the sort of thing they're wanting. I'm assuming you might mean things like universal health care, or I guess free tertiary education back in the day was that sort of populist measure on the progressive side.
Correct. And broader than that, it also includes things like access and equality of access to government services, appropriate health care, education, even things like infrastructure, roads, all of those things are really important. For the left, of course, it's tinged with real scepticism about the impact of multinational corporations and the impact that businesses are having on the community. For the right, the scepticism tends to be focused on things like globalisation, international organisations, and as we heard with Pauline Hanson just a moment ago, a scepticism about immigration as well.
You're listening to Dr. Zareh Ghazarian. We're talking about populism, whether it's on the left or the right. What do you think the Greens would be thinking in answer to that? Of course, the Greens Party leader of the UK saying that he has taken on Reform UK, which is, again, been, you know, compared to One Nation or vice versa for many, many, many years now. Do you think that progressive politics, progressive populism in Australia would work as well as it is making headway in the UK?
What we're seeing really in the polls is that Australians are keen to support non-major party candidates. And at the moment, obviously, One Nation seems to be the beneficiary of that, with some polls suggesting that it is number one, outpolling the major parties. But at the same time, parties like the Greens have long established histories in Australian politics. And for them, the party is going to be tested by their capacity to try and take voters along this journey. Both strategies, both from the right and left, is going to try and exploit this idea that people have been left behind by major party policies. Mm. For the Greens, though, what we're seeing is their focus is going to be very much on this idea that they can spin that and provide a more positive story for those who are concerned about where the major parties are going, but aren't really ready to vote for the One Nation Party at the moment.
Zareh, you bring up a point that's always fascinated me, this idea of being positive about it, and yet populism, even in the words of Zach Polanski, means tapping into anger as well. Mm. Populism is also driven by this discontent, isn't it? How do you reconcile, or how do populists reconcile the anger with the solution?
I think that's the key, and that's where populist candidates tend to struggle. Harnessing anger ultimately means delivering in terms of policy outcomes. And what we do see is that when parties, candidates that align with populist approaches do get into power, they are often frustrated by the rules of the game, the systems that they confront, and the challenges of bringing about the sorts of promises they want to do. For the Greens, though, I think we see hints of where they want to go, and that is that the tapping into anger is ultimately going to provide them with the opportunity to promote their policy agenda. And that, I think, is where the positive element comes in for the party, that they feel that they can propose actual workable solutions to people's concerns.
Zarei, thank you for your time today.
Pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Zarei Ghazarian, a political scientist at Monash University. What do you think? Are we looking, is it the time? Is it the moment? Is it the opportunity for populism in the progressive parties? Let me know. We're also talking about school absences that are maybe not approved by the principals, maybe not even acknowledged from the families. Nicola, you're on the road, are you? Have you taken your child out of school?
Yes.
Where are you going?
So we have just left Point Lonsdale in Victoria, and we are heading for 7 months up the centre of Australia, down the west, and then back along South Australia and home.
Oh, fantastic. Now, did you get approval?
Yes, we did. We emailed the principal and we told him about it, and he was very supportive of it.
And what, you didn't get any pushback then? And did you get support to do it? As in, did you get the educational support that you will need on the road?
Yes, well, I have had other friends that have done it. Some of them are primary teachers themselves. They made a few recommendations, and then the kids' teachers provided us with some materials as well. And we're also really supportive of, you know, setting up some Zoom chats for the kids to talk with their classes while they're away and send through photos so that the rest of their class can kind of participate.
And why did you do it, Nicola? Why do you think this is going to be good?
Well, my husband did it as a child and he still talks about it. So this was his kind of bucket list trip that we wanted to do with the kids when they were in primary school before we hit high school and whatnot. And it just seemed like a wonderful adventure to have as a family, just a real circuit break from life.
Absolutely. How good a teacher do you think you're going to be on the road, Nicola?
Ooh, well, look, I come from a family of teachers.
Oh, okay. You've got a head
start. I'm hoping something will, you know, sink in. We'll see.
Good luck with the maths and everything else, Nicola. Really appreciate you leaning into the conversation. Tell me, is this what you're about to do? Do you still remember it from years and years ago? I'd love to hear from you. Also coming up this hour, yes, we have been talking about dressing in black. I know Ali Moore did her What If on this last Friday. We have discovered apparently there is a scientific reason potentially why we're all wearing black. I also want to ask you, is it a Melbourneian cliche only? Maybe you're in the regions. Maybe you're out there in Warrnambool swanning around in your all black outfit. I'd love to hear from you. 1300 222 774. Chris, you're in Pakenham. What's your relationship with the black wardrobe?
You sound like it sound ominous.
I don't mean it to be.
No, at high school, primary school, where I grew up in Newcastle, all our house, like sporting houses, names and stuff like that, were all taken from coal mines. So I think the scene was set early, and our house colour, other houses had different colours, red, blue, whatever. We had black.
Oh, that's fantastic! You were the chicest group in the school.
Well, yeah, not good if you've got dandruff, though. But
do you still wear black, Chris, then?
Yeah, I was going to say I ride a motorbike. The motorbike's black. I've been motorcyclist for years. I used to be a roadie for about a decade. So, yeah, black was the part of the uniform. I still wear it. I've got a noir wardrobe, as I put it. it's very... like those European movies, everybody's smoking, and yeah, it's very
very stylish,
bogan
chic. Well, I might outbogan you, Chris, because as I'm getting older, I'm leaning towards sort of Dr. Carl shirts occasionally as well. You're not breaking out into bursts of colour in between the noir chic. You're not tempted.
No, not unless I want to gouge my eyes out. But
oh, Chris, I'll warn you if I'm ever wearing it.
No, not you, no me. Yes, no, people will do that. I think it would be really upsetting for people if they saw me in colours. I've set a trend over decades, and I'm not. It's not
your identity's caught up with it.
It's not really a conscious choice. It's just that I That's what I do. It's wear black. I do wear blue jeans sometimes.
Oh, there you go. Breaking out,
yeah.
Chris.
Yeah, well, yeah, I've
well
made
done.
Progress.
Chris, thank you. That's great. I'm glad I'm on radio as far as you're concerned then. You don't have to look at my loud shirts. Thank you for calling in very soon coming up in this hour. We will be talking about apparently there's a scientific and cultural reasons why we are going towards black. So if you are needing to defend it to your loved ones, stick around and hear that conversation. That's coming up soon. But and also very soon, we're going to be talking about Warwick Long. On the road, we're talking dairy prices.
This is the Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
Christine Sunshine says, Mary, I'm going to call it. It's vanity. Black is slimming. And while I'm in the thick of menopause and on the wrong side of 50, I need all the help I can get. That is Christy's reason for wearing black. Very soon we're going to be hearing there are other reasons, things we don't even think about for why we wear black. That's coming up soon. Also, we will be speaking soon to Warwick Long. But I also did want to mention that you might have heard Raf talking to a fella called John from Ringwood on 774 last week. He called in. If you didn't hear it, he told Raf that he hadn't eaten for 3 days. That's right, he hadn't eaten for 3 days. So we decided here we wanted to do something to help people like John who are doing it tough. So they've launched the 774's Meal for Melbourne. We've launched it. It's an old-fashioned food drive, collecting food for Food Bank to distribute to people in need. So if you're in Melbourne, you can drop off unopened, non-perishable food items at the cafe here at ABC South Bank. The cafe is called Laku, L-A-K-U, and you can do that between 6 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. Things like cans of veggies or soup, packets of rice, it all comes in so handy. There's information also on the sort of things you can drop off if you go to abc.net.au/Melbourne. If you can't make it into ABC South Bank, if you're in the regions, we will be setting up a virtual food pantry and you can find that link as well on abc.net.au/Melbourne. That is to help people like John. If you haven't heard his story, I really recommend that you go back and hear him talking to Raf. And it's wonderful. He's in good hands now. His mates have given him lots of food and he's feeling really buoyed by all of the support from all of the kind calls that all of you have given. So that's Meals for Melbourne. Now, if you are in the regions from 12, you can join Warwick Long. He's in the dairy conference at Ballarat. And he joins me now. Hi, Warwick.
G'day, Mary. Sadly, not wearing black today.
Oh, what black colours?
Blue, and it's a blue, red and white shirt. There you go. It's a little bit loud. I'm not a big black guy. I'm more of a colour guy. So yeah. It's probably good I'm
it's
in the regions.
Me. Oh, well. Yeah. Well, I believe there's black in the regions. I want people to tell me about it. But what are you... I can hear the noise behind you, Warwick.
Yeah.
What's happening?
It's just funnily enough, we're at the United Dairy Farmers of Victoria conference today. And it turns out to be really the biggest day on the calendar if you're a dairy farmer right now, because as we speak, Mary, you and I, it's World Milk Day too
yep.
today. So
World
happy
Milk
World
Day.
Milk Day to
happy
you.
Happy World Milk Day, everybody.
And to everybody who celebrates, yeah. By 2 o'clock today, the prices that will be paid for over 8 billion litres of milk in Australia have to be released for the year ahead. And what we're seeing right at the moment is a lot of dairy companies keeping their cards close to their chest. So right now, I'm in a room with an enormous amount of really nervous dairy farmers wanting to know how much they'll be paid over the next financial year for their product. And this is due to something called the Milk Pricing Code. It came about after the collapse of Murray Goulburn, which was an iconic, really large milk processor in Australia. And in response to that, a milk price code of conduct governed by the ACCC is in place. And today's the date. By 2 o'clock on the 1st of June, or the first Monday if the 1st of June falls on a weekend, every dairy company in Australia, every company that buys milk from farmers, has to announce a minimum milk price for the year ahead.
And so how do they decide that, Woz?
Well, through everything, right? So at the moment, they've got an Iran war to deal with if they're an export company trying to work out what the global price is, what the Australian dollar's doing, how much some of their inputs and outputs are going to cost, and try and put together a price for dairy farmers. But dairy farmers are doing the same thing themselves, so they're wanting to know what the minimum milk price is. And for other companies too, it's about, managing how much consumers are willing to pay for things like dairy and how much we're importing from overseas, because we import. Mm. Last year we imported $1 billion worth of dairy from other countries. That's wow. Despite us having a dairy industry ourselves here, right? So,
is that because we just can't produce enough, or is it different sorts of goods that we're asking for?
We've seen an enormous amount of shrinking in the dairy industry this century. So over the last 25 years or so, the dairy industry, not quite half, but it's gone from 13 billion litres of milk produced every year in Australia to about 8. So we've seen this huge fall off in the amount of milk being produced. That's due to things like the cost of producing it. There's only so many areas in Australia which are suited to dairy farming, and a lot of them are some of the most expensive farmland that you can get. You know, areas like Gippsland close to Melbourne, areas like southwest Victoria, where it's traditionally been really reliable and expensive to buy land. And then things like not getting enough for milk, and us not sending as much overseas as we used to, and that's seen this incredible shrinking of the dairy industry. And that's why days like today are so important, because dairy farmers want to know, am I going to make the same or more, or heaven forbid, a cut to their milk price for the next year ahead, and what does that mean for their budgets? And then they have a month to decide, because it's that milk price starts to get paid on the 1st of July in the new financial year, and will go for 12 months. So
they get to decide their approach to the year ahead.
They get to decide if they want to keep dairy farming at all, or if they want to sell their cows off, or if they want to change companies. So all the companies are putting out their minimum milk prices at the moment. So you have these large multinationals and supermarkets and little cheese companies and all sorts of things in dairy all releasing their milk price today. And then negotiations will quickly happen between dairy farmers and those companies to decide where that milk's going to go. So when I say quite literally, for the next 4 weeks, billions of litres of milk are hanging in the air. That's what's happening right now, all before we get to the supermarket and have to walk to the back of the supermarket.
I know, we're not doing the hard work.
Warwick,
you've painted a really good picture there of all of the headwinds that the dairy farmers are facing. From when you're talking to them, how are they feeling? What's the sort of the mood that you're detecting at the moment?
It's a really hard one to sum up, because there are different levels to the dairy industry at the moment, but it has been a difficult industry to be in, and there is still a lot of exhaustion from sort of a couple of difficult decades in dairy farming and what that has meant to a certain type of farmer, particularly the smaller family farms. Some of the larger built-up ones that can probably deal with some of the ups and downs a little bit more easily. They can grow more of their own food. They can get better deals on things like fuel and fertiliser because they're just physically bigger. There's still some excitement for the industry there, but no matter who you talk to, there's concern in the dairy industry about the fact that we're getting smaller still year on year. And that hasn't really, that decline hasn't stopped for any sort of long period of time. And there's concern the more dairy farmers that leave, what does that mean to the factories and the stainless steel out there that are, you know, in a position to process that milk? Because if they go, then you're in a much more difficult period for the dairy industry. So all of that's going on in the background. But there's a lot of love for this industry at the same time, Mary, and I hope I give you some of that too, because there's a lot of people here that absolutely love breeding cows, milking cows, being around cows every day, and producing things like dairy for milk, yogurts, butters, ice cream, and everything else you
want. And all the things that I love, all the strength to their arm. Warwick, how can we listen to you today?
Country has on regional Victorian ABC radio, so you can find us online, but we also are a podcast as well, so just search Victorian Country Hour wherever you are, and you can listen back to us when maybe something's on the radio that you don't quite like, not Conversation Hour, but other things.
No, not that.
You can tune in for those times. And Mary, one more thing if I may.
Yes.
I took my kids out of school for term 3, and we went around the middle of Australia and down WA, and I know you're talking about this.
Yeah.
We did speak to our school about it. They were very happy for us to do it when we were in primary school, and the only thing they told us to do was make sure the kids keep a diary. It doesn't have to be every day, but make sure that they're writing something and keeping memories of what they did, and I wouldn't have swapped it for quids. It is one of the best things I've ever done. And thank you to, it was Guthrie Street Primary School where our kids were at the time, for giving us that advice, because it gave us the freedom not to be stressed about the kids learning something every day. It gave us time to enjoy it, but also make sure we document those memories.
Warwick Long, I reckon you'd be a great maths teacher. Thank you so much.
Thanks, mate.
That's Warwick Long on your radio from 12 on the Country Hour, and you can find it in the ABC Listen app. Samantha says black clothing is dreadful. So drab. There's not a single item of black in my wardrobe. Melbourne looks terrible in all its black attire. What do you think? And if you're outside of Melbourne, is it just us? Is it just people in this area? Tell me, do you wear black in the regions? We're going to be coming up talking to someone who's a fashion designer and lecturer who believes that there are more things going on when we're reaching for the black in our wardrobe. That is coming up next on The Conversation Hour.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Do you wear black? Is it just Melbourne? Across Victoria, call me. Is it the regions as well? 1300 222 774. Is it black in Bendigo, black in Beechworth? I would love to hear from you. Joining me now is Jai Marshall, who's fashion designer and lecturer in fashion design at Swinburne. Thanks for joining us, Jai.
Thanks for having me, Mary. And are you wearing some black clothing today?
I'm not. And I'm veering towards very loud shirts. I'll confess it right now, Jai. But you've written a piece looking at why our obsession, so if we believe it's not just a cliche, with black clothing actually does make sense. I'm asking people why they wear black and what they think about it. 1300 222 774. Jai, is it something beyond just that ability to make sure that your tops match your bottoms?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Jumping on the train this morning and looking around the first day of winter, I noticed a lot more people wearing black today. And there are a couple of things that come down to why more people might wear black in winter or in a city like Melbourne. I think a lot of it does come down to climate. A lot of people like to mimic their climate. And in Melbourne, we know that it's notoriously cold. And generally, people tend to reach for darker clothing items.
Does it mean anything for the body? Is it just psychological, or does black make you warmer?
Just psychological.
Okay.
I mean, obviously, when you're getting that small glimmer of sunlight, obviously black attracts heat a lot more than some of those brighter colours. But I think it really comes down to layering. A lot of black clothes are really good base layers, and particularly in winter, people like to layer up quite a lot, which does add that extra warmth and benefit. And black does go with a lot of different styles and silhouettes, and therefore I think why it's an easy choice for people to just grab out in winter when they're already thinking about so much.
Why do you wear black? Is it just a cliche? Is it in the regions? Is it not just about Melbourne? 1300 222 774. John, you're in Euroa. What do you think?
I think that black has no place in a Melbourne winter. It really does not. It's gloomy and dark and depressing. The only advantage of black clothing is it does dry quicker in the sun. It does. But look, we really need more colour in our life. There are mental health shirts now coming out, and they're colourful, they're bright, and they let the sunshine in, and everyone feel happy. And I think that's important.
So you think we should dress in colours, if not for ourselves, for other people?
Yes. Well, for each other. For each other. Look, we've been through a bit of a traumatic time here with the bushfires, and I can only see the people up in the Ruffey Hub, for instance, are all wearing colourful clothes.
Oh, yeah, John, you raise a really good point. Thank you so much for calling. Jai, it is true. You were talking there about psychologically what black means. For some people it does mean, you know, depression and so forth. What else does it mean, do you think, in Melbourne? Why are we attracted to it, in particular in the city?
Yeah, in Melbourne, particularly in the city, we've had a big investment in creative arts, and I would say that Melbourne as a city compared to other cities are known for its arts and its appreciation of arts. And there's a really long history of our actors, architects, graphic designers, fashion designers, all wearing black as a notion of really making their work sell rather than being quite, showy and wanting to make sure that their creativity is really the highlight of the show rather than their person. But I do think what John is coming through there, he's made a really great statement around how it doesn't have to be that way, how we can also still have, self-identity through lots of different colours. I think, I wear a really bright bright green jacket during winter, and I get so many comments because it just stands out like a sea across all this kind of black-coloured clothing. But I do think it kind of comes back to our kind of place branding and identity of Melbourne, as well as the fact that Melbourne's a very European city. We've got the largest Italian community, a very large Greek community, which, black clothing in a European sense has kind of come in and out at various points of history across.
Louise from Blackburn has texted in. Oh, I beg your pardon, Jai. What did you say then?
Oh, black coloured clothing used to be used at weddings and examples like that. It hasn't always been a sad colour.
I was just also seeing Louise's text saying you'll find in Milan black is extremely popular colour. It's so stylish and easy to wear. That's our European heritage.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. European, and I think Melbourne, when we compare to Sydney, we would probably say Sydney's more, coastal, and they can get away with having lots of vibrant colours, very LA vibe, where Melbourne has a very different European feel about it. We're very into our arts, and that comes along with taking our arts very seriously. And, a lot of graphic designers and artists that I work with tend to wear head-to-toe black because they take themselves very seriously in terms of their artistic sense.
Roger, you've called in from Serpentine. What do you think?
Yes, hello. I'm just on my way to Bridgewater and I just heard your program just now and I'd like to know, a bit of a conundrum, why is it that people that wear a lot of black probably go home to a house which is painted white on the inside?
Oh, you think if they're really committed, they need to have black around them all the time?
Absolutely. You're going to be wanting to live in a black box.
What do you think, Jai?
Yeah, I think that's a great comment. I think really sticking to your identity there and making sure you're committing to everything. I think for me personally, I'm very creative. I have the most amount of colours in my house. I'm always working with lots of different colours. Mm. So sometimes I think also wearing black every day can, when we think of people like Steve Jobs, for example, he continuously always had a black wardrobe because it meant that every morning he never had to make a decision. He could just be wearing the same
exactly.
kind of clothes. So I think lots of people choose to wear black in different reasons, and it doesn't particularly mean that you have to go all black.
Of course not. Yes, Andrea from Glen Iris is saying black is a lazy choice, but that goes to ease then, doesn't it? But also Dee from Ballarat is saying Ballarat black is a thing, not just Melbourne, Jai.
I love that. I think there's so many, thinking of a sustainability consideration as well, we all need people to be holding onto their clothes for so much longer. What one advantage of wearing black does have is that we are continuing to hold onto those pieces a lot longer. They serve as those hallmark pieces which get passed down. When we think of leather jackets or black clothing or an investment piece, generally people tend to go for safer colours like black, navy or white because they last a lot longer. So I do think there are many reasons why people wear black, but it's definitely there's so many different subcultural themes coming through.
Yeah. Pauline agrees black is economical if you don't have a lot of money to spend on clothing, so practical in more ways than one. Geeta, you're in Williamstown. What do you think? Do you see black out and about?
Oh, yes. I'm actually dressed head to toe in black today.
I bet it's very stylish as well, Geeta.
Well, I don't know, but it's very practical for all the reasons Jai was referring to. Makes it simpler to dress. But I was also thinking about what Jai was talking in terms of culture and the association between black and culture and the arts and dressing in regional Victoria. I was in Anglesey for the weekend and visiting a friend, and she took me to a string quartet concert at the Memorial Hall there in Anglesey. Mm-hmm. And I observed that everyone in the audience was quite brightly dressed. And the entire string quartet was head to toe in black. And they looked magnificent and very appropriate for a string quartet. And I think there is an association with the arts and culture. And I grew up in the UK and England. And I think I did note in Europe, that sort of black is very much associated with the arts and culture. And
do you think the Anglesey folks might take it on now?
No.
Geeta, thank you. That's a really interesting observation, isn't it? It is about that artistic sort of costume as well. I love this on text, and it matches something in your article, Jai, so I just want to say it. I was once asked by this texter says, by a young person in a class I was training, why I wore black. When I answered jokingly but with a straight face, it matches my mood. She looked scared. I have to confess to a frisson of pleasure at this. And you quote Yoji Yamamoto, who says, above all, black says, I don't bother you, don't bother me.
I love that. That's so great.
Do you believe it is a bit of armour, even if it is also a little bit of ease?
It could be. It could be. A little bit of armour, perhaps, for some people, but I think at most for ease. But it's really interesting, you know, even some of the research going back to, say, medieval era, you know, when people were thinking about the royalty and luxury of having black fabric and things like that. There's so many interesting angles you could take at this angle. But I think, you know, Melbourne's doing such a great job of it.
Mm, indeed. Jai, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Mary.
Go off and rock that black. Jai Marshall, fashion designer and lecturer in fashion design at Swinburne. Ali in Ocean Grove says, I wear all black so I can be seen amongst all the high fluoro, high vis. This is true. There's a lot of that around as well. Renata says, black is art and rock and roll, cool, edgy, yet elegant, stylish and classic as well. Whatever you're wearing, go out there and rock it, whether it is black, whether you are in Melbourne or the regions. Thank you so much for joining me on the Conversation Hour today. You can listen again on the ABC Listen app and write to me, conversationhour@abc.net.au is the address.